There have been some wonderful worship services in the past few weeks, don't you think? I have loved hearing the voices and the stories and the teaching coming from within our congregation, from our pew mates. And I'm honored to have, and humbled to have been asked to share with you a little bit of what my journey has been like, what I've been thinking about and grappling with along the way. So I'll begin with a story told by one of my favorite insight meditation teachers, Tara Brach, from her book, Radical Acceptance. In the 1950s, a few highly trained pilots in the U.S. Air Force were set a life or death task to fly at altitudes higher than ever before attempted. Going beyond the Earth's denser atmosphere, they found, much to their horror, that the ordinary laws of aerodynamics no longer existed. As Tom Wolfe describes it in The Right Stuff, a plane could skid into a flat spin like a cereal bowl on a waxed Formica counter and then start tumbling, not spinning and diving, but tumbling end over end. The first pilots to face this challenge responded frantically, trying to stabilize their planes, applying correction after correction. The more furiously they manipulated the controls, the wilder the ride became. Screaming helplessly to ground control, "What do I do next?" they would plunge to their deaths. This tragic drama occurred several times until one of the pilots, Chuck Yeager, inadvertently struck upon a solution. When his plane began tumbling, Yeager was thrown violently around the cockpit and knocked out. Unconscious, he plummeted toward Earth. 7 miles later, the plane re-entered the planet's denser atmosphere where the standard navigation strategies could be implemented. Yeager came to, steadied the craft, and landed safely. He had discovered the only life-saving response that was possible in this desperate situation. Don't do anything. You take your hands off the controls. Now, I tend to be a bit of a planner. Part of my morning routine, when I finally sit down with that first life-affirming cup of coffee, is making the to-do list for the day. What's carried over from yesterday? Where do I have to go and when? What do I need to do for work, for the house, for mom, for the animals, for me? I may not always like the length of the list for the day or its shape, and I usually know full well that there's no way I'm going to get done everything that I write down, but I like the act of writing it and the sense that I have control over the stretch of time between the writing and when I go to bed that night. But there's the rub. It's only a sense of control. The reality, played out over and over and over again, is that I have very little power over what unfolds during the day. Here might be a typical list. Do kitty litter. Unload dishwasher. Walk track at the community center. Tidy up desk. This is almost always on the list. Draft newsletter for work. Write SGM session plan. Mom to doctor, 11 a.m. Groceries. Yoga, 4:30. You get the drift. And here might be how the day goes. Kitty litter. Check. After replacing the light bulb in the kitchen that I only noticed was out when I flipped the switch, I start to unload dishwasher, but hear phone chime indicating text message. And after that exchange with a friend, I use said phone to check email, answer a couple of them, look at the weather forecast, catch up on all my Words with Friends games, see what's happening on Facebook, by which time I need to get ready to go get mom. Mom to doctor, check. Followed by lunch and a trip to the pharmacy and doing a couple of things around her house, by which time, no time to go to the track at the community center because draft newsletter, yes, partially, but realize need more details for one article, so send out some emails soliciting input. Also decide to freshen up one of the graphics, which means surfing images for 45 minutes. And then realizing that work laptop is having some sort of issue, which means more research about how to clear the cache out of Google Chrome. And yoga, check, but just barely, and now nothing for dinner because no trip to grocery store. desk a worse mess than yesterday. And so it goes. Stuff happens. It is said that the Buddha once asked a student, if a person is struck by an arrow, is it painful? If the person is struck by a second arrow, is it more painful? He then went on to explain, in life, we can't always control the first arrow. However, the second arrow is our reaction to the first. The second arrow is optional. So in the case of my to-do list, do the changes of course due to the unexpected obstacles mean that I've had a good day or a bad day? Am I a productive, worthy, striving, responsible person? Or an easily distracted, undisciplined, lazy slacker whose failures will show up on tomorrow's list? How do I react? How do I choose to respond? The Buddha's arrow parable is sometimes summarized as pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. I don't know, honestly, if I would take it that far. I have an aversion to tiny little platitudes anyway, and it's quite possible that I'm just not far enough along the path to realize the truth of that. But I do know from observation and experience that how we respond to the obstacles in our path matters. And that the response which minimizes our tendency to continue to shoot ourselves with additional arrows is to, as fully as we are able, accept the reality of the pain of the first one and then let it go. It's simple. It's not easy. It all takes practice, this learning to pause, to let go of what reactivity we can through the nurturing of mindfulness and compassion. Chuck Yeager had to be knocked unconscious to interrupt this deep desire to control. These subsequent arrows, this additional suffering, might look like wrapping ourselves up tightly in stories of how the first arrow came to be and how we should have known to avoid it, or deal more skillfully with the person who shot it, or how we always seem to be getting riddled with arrows, or are too stupid to avoid walking in the archer's sight lines, or are too forgetful to put on our armor. Sometimes I think it would be helpful if I just drew arrows on post-it notes and put them all over my house, like on my computer monitor, certainly on my refrigerator, and definitely on the dashboard of my car, as a reminder that I need not react to the bad or merely careless behaviors of other drivers. I don't have to be angry about being cut off or slowed down. That's my choice. We can understand that there is part of our brain that likes to have a clear cause for every effect, whether it's a rainbow or thunder or an eclipse or burnt toast or a stubbed toe. But we also can understand that we can breathe, choose to just let the toe hurt for a few minutes, and then perhaps move the laundry basket back to the closet where it belongs without a huge, big, complex thing about it. And of course, sometimes the best we can do is realize that we've gone off again and think about forgiving ourselves for the second arrow, or the third, or the fourth. As Muhammad Ali once said, it isn't the mountains ahead to climb that wear you out, it's the pebble in your shoe. It's funny, or maybe just a little ironic, that there's been truth in this for me, that the little stuff is trying. Maybe we just have the human spirit or resilience, or maybe it's just adrenaline that helps us to rise to the occasion for the big unwelcome events, sometimes. My father would have celebrated his 80th birthday earlier this past week, so he's been on my mind a bit more than usual of late. It was early July in 2007, and my wife, Fenn, and I were happily settling into the family cottage up on Southport, Maine, for a week's vacation. The manse, as we affectionately call the 100-plus-year-old frame house, has a great old clawfoot bathtub. And it must have been around 4:30 or 5 p.m. that I was just settling into the bubbles with the latest brand new Harry Potter book in hardcover and an adult beverage. It was my idea of heaven. The phone rings. Fen comes into the bathroom shaken and says, "It's your mom and it's really bad." I try to stop the worst of the dripping and the puddling and pick up the phone in an adjacent bedroom. "Laura, sit down." I can hear mom's voice shaking. "Are you sitting down?" "Sit down." I don't sit. "Mom, what's happened? It's dad, isn't it?" I surmise this because she is the one who's calling. "Well, yes, it was dad." The big unexpected piece was not that he had just died, but that he had taken his own life. My 68-year-old father, pillar of the church, handyman to the neighborhood, person of few words and solid deeds and certain beliefs. No warning, no note, no fathomable explanation. It was that day that I learned that it is simply not possible to fly from the East Coast of the United States to the Midwest after about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. After sharing the news with a few friends and family and talking to my beyond distraught brother in California and gathering up all of our vacation stuff, we drove home to Kittery Point, packed for a trip to Michigan, including funeral attire, and started our drive out. And what startled me the most, that long night of driving, of weeping, of wondering, of trying to believe this reality, this unspeakable shock, what surprised me the most during the long pause of a forced drive of several hundred miles through the wee hours was this refrain in my head of, "Well, why not me? Why not us?" Now, don't get me wrong, I was sad, angry, embarrassed, instantly weighted down with a realization that my life was permanently changed and likely laden with temporary and ongoing responsibilities that I was not looking for. And there were moments then, and there still are now, that I behave fairly badly around it all. But there was also this quiet understanding that this was a piece of not just my suffering, but the suffering, that pain in life that every living being has. And this was just a piece that fell on my path right now. And just that little bit of space, of distance, seemed to make putting foot A in front of foot B a little bit more possible in an impossible time. A lot of great thinkers and spiritual leaders have written on the topic of the dark night of the soul, of times of great struggle and bleakness and hardships and challenges, that stuff that happens with the notion that this is where our growth comes from. Paul, in his letter to the Romans in the Christian Bible, pointed out that where sin abounds, there grace does much more abound. He does go on to point out that this is no excuse to keep sinning, however. A little rhyme I learned as a child goes, "Experience is a teacher, but here's what makes me burn. She's always teaching me the things I do not care to learn." Winemakers in Napa Valley are fond of saying, "The more stressed the vine, the better the wine." Or, as the Buddhists say, "No mud, no lotus." So does that mean that we are called to be grateful for the unexpected obstacles on our path, the unplanned, unwelcome moments that feel like they're wrecking our lives? Do we give thanks for the frightening diagnosis, the grueling treatment, the sudden pain, the broken relationship, the betrayal, the loss of a job, the relapse into that which we know does not serve us? Should I be grateful that my father took his own life? I think the practice of learning not to fire arrows into ourselves just might allow us to recognize that the skills and abilities and deepening that we acquire from allowing things to be what they are, even when they are unwelcome, can serve us in our lives and generally make our journey a more peaceful and productive one. My dad is gone, and his choice to go and way of going has had deep impact on many people. Among what I have learned from that experience are that suicide is deeply stigmatized still in some places and in some circles, and that there can be real complications to that grief, and that I have no idea what another human being is thinking and feeling at any point in time, even if I think I know them well, and that showing up for someone else's grief matters. Cards matter. And checking in a year or 2 years later matters. And speaking the names of our departed beloveds matter. And hearing the names of our beloveds spoken matters. And that every tear needs to be shed. Certainly my dad's death left me better prepared for the pain and grief when Fenn died a little over 3 years ago, after 23 years of our life together. And although I can't imagine ever honestly saying that I am grateful for either loss, I am deeply grateful for those lessons. In this community, right in this space, I have found and believe that I will continue to find and have contributed to and hope that I will continue to contribute to the alleviation of suffering, of making the way a little bit easier in the little daily frustrations, and in the big, unwelcome, unexpected. Here is a place where we can listen to each other and offer the possibility of a pause. Coming into this sanctuary for an hour is a pause. We can actually ask for actual help, and we can offer real support. We can sit together and walk together and work together and contemplate avoiding the second arrow, or the third, or the fourth. We can remind each other to consider the gifts that may come from challenges and how we might honor our suffering by how we use the teachings that arise from it. As Jane so eloquently reminded us in David White's beautiful poem, the lesson is this: to empty your bags, to sort this and leave that, and to abandon the shoes that brought you here right at the water's edge, not because you had given up, but because now you would find a different way to tread. And because through it all, part of you would still walk on, no matter how, over the waves. And perhaps in time, we come to see, as we make our way individually and collectively, with or without our careful to-do lists and plans, that we need not try to avoid or resist or control the obstacles in our path. They simply are our path. And we walk on. Amen and blessed be.